A look at today's jobs report, which economists say exceeded expectations, the U.S. economy adding 295,000 jobs. And last month, that made it the 12th straight month of gains over 200,000. Unemployment fell to 5.5%, its lowest level since May 2008. Mike Regan is an editor for Bloomberg News. He's with us from New York. And Mike, 295,000 jobs added last month. Your response to that?
Well, it's a great number. You know, it obviously shows that the labor market is holding on to this momentum. This is, you know, several long stretch of months above 200,000. And as you said, the unemployment rate at 5.5% is a 7-year low. You know, it wasn't a completely great report. There was a revision in the prior 2 months that reduced about 18,000 jobs off of the reports from those months, but more than made up for by the strong month in February. The average economist estimate was only for 235,000 jobs. So this is 60,000 more than that, a very good number for the economy.
Well, that 12-month gain streak is the most since, I think, 1977. And this is despite, some are pointing out, the fact that a lot of the Northeast was kind of stalled all winter, all February because of the snow.
It is. And, you know, remember, these numbers are seasonally adjusted by the Labor Department. But that said, you know, a really bad month like February, a really cold month, can throw a monkey wrench into these numbers, even though they are seasonally adjusted, and cause them to miss. So it is very interesting to see that they beat economists' estimates by such a wide margin, even though it was such a lousy month weather-wise.
And just touch on what kinds of jobs are hiring.
The Labor Department singled out a few industries, food services and drinking places, so bars and restaurants, basically. And that's not too much of a surprise if you've been paying attention to the earnings reports coming out from companies for the fourth quarter. You know, the cheap gasoline has really caused people to dine out more than they had been. So there's, you know, a lot of waiters and bartenders and waitresses being added. They also said professional and business services, which is a very broad category. Construction also was among the top gains, and healthcare and transportation and warehousing. So pretty diverse, wide-ranging gains in jobs.
Take a closer look at that unemployment rate. As you said, dropping to 5.5% must be painful for those, you know, still looking for work. But is this people quitting looking or being hired?
It's mostly being hired. Remember, these are two separate surveys that the Labor Department does. The unemployment rate is gathered from a survey of households, and the number of jobs added is from the it's called the establishment survey. So that's actually surveying companies. The one thing that did happen is the labor force participation rate, and that is the percentage of people actively in the workforce dropped to 62.8% from just a little bit higher, 62.9%. That's near the lowest level since the 1970s. It's not quite exactly the lowest level, which was 62.7, but it is, you know, remaining towards that low. And there's really a few reasons you could glean for that. Yeah. Some people might just be dropping out of the workforce because they're discouraged. But also, you know, the stock market's doing well. So some older people may be able to retire a little earlier and feel better about their finances. So, it's hard to read too much into that because it's been a long-running trend since the labor force participation rate peaked in 2000. It's really been on a downward slope ever since.
And by the way, again, 62.8% of people who want to are participating in the labor force. That seems low, but what was the peak?
The peak was 67.3% in 2000. So, you know, not that far off, but it is,
not that far off.
You know,
okay.
This number does tend to stay fairly close to the same. So that is a pretty big drop as far as this number goes from 2000.
Okay. Mike Regan of Bloomberg News with a look at the jobs reports that came out today. Again, 12 straight months of gains, and including in February, 295,000 jobs added. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, 12 straight months of gains, over 200,000 jobs. Pretty impressive report. Testimony is over for the first week in the trial of now-admitted Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev. A long line of victims and first responders have already taken the stand. David Boeri from Here and Now contributor WBUR reports that the defense so far is contesting nothing, and a warning that David's report contains graphic descriptions that may not be suitable for everyone.
On the first day, the jurors had been like soldiers hitting the beach in battle. What they saw and heard of shrapnel, shredded flesh, and amputated legs on the day of April 15, 2013 had shocked them. By day two, the jurors had to know what they were in for. They could well understand one witness's description that what happened had looked like a war movie. "Your knee joint is something that anyone who has two legs takes for granted," testified bombing victim Roseanne Soya. She had walked into the courtroom on two prosthetic legs with a side-to-side gait of one whose legs have been cut off above the knee. After watching the Red Sox game at Fenway Park, she had gone to see the marathon. Her life changed forever with two flashes of white light she saw at her feet. "All I could see was blood pouring out of where my knee should have been," Soya said. She described seeing a little foot on the ground with a sock on it, next to where she was lying. "I had to ask," she said, "if I had put socks on that morning and whether it was mine." Knowing she was bleeding out, Soya said she gave someone her sister's phone number because I didn't want somebody calling my parents to say I was dead. A fellow amputee, Rebecca Gregory, cried openly, and during the day at least four jurors trembled, shuddered, and welled up. The jurors clearly liked these witnesses. There was Jeffrey Bowman, the focus of the photo that became an icon of the carnage and heroism that day. He sits in a wheelchair, lower legs missing, a medic and a man in a cowboy hat pushing frantically. Resolutely upbeat, Bowman told the prosecutor that Erin, the girlfriend who he had gone to see run that day, was now his wife. "She said yes," he said, and the jurors had a rare and thankful moment of laughter. "I was thinking I've had a great life. I kind of made peace with myself," he said, while he was preparing for death. When he woke up in a hospital room, Bowman exclaimed, "I saw the kid. I knew what happened." Bowman testified that before the first blast, he had seen someone who looked very suspicious, someone who was alone with a backpack that he left unattended before it blew up. Bowman had even had his breathing tube removed so he could talk with investigators and help them draw a suspect sketch of the man who turned out to be Tamerlan Zanayev. Bowman would leave the stand with the same swaying gait that indicated he too lost his legs above the knee. Like all the other witnesses over 2 days, he went unquestioned by defense attorneys.
"I mean, there's nothing you can do with these witnesses."
Attorney Robert Sheketoff defended Gary Sampson, who was charged with two carjacking murders in a death penalty case before the federal court here in Boston. "There is no chance of Zanayev winning the case," Sheketoff says, "and no way of defending against these victim witnesses."
"It's not like you can make this go away. You can't make this go away no matter what your strategy is."
The defense dares not question such sympathetic witnesses in front of the jury, so it's likely there will be no defense on most of the charges. But why not plead guilty? Why not get it over with and move to the sentencing phase of the trial? Because, Sheketoff says, it's important to give an angry jury a chance to agree with the government in a case you can't win.
"If you let them say he's guilty, at least they got to make a public pronouncement. It's good for them psychologically. It then puts them in a better psychological position to be fairer sentencing."
That, Sheketoff says, may be the hope the defense has for saving the life of Zanayev, who seemed a small, disconnected figure in the courtroom, dwarfed by stories of human tragedy, heroism, and transcendent grace. Boston police officer Lauren Woods testified about attending to BU graduate student Lindsay Liu. When an EMT stopped doing chest compressions, telling Woods that Liu wasn't going to make it, and he had to move on to other victims, Woods continued. She found Lou's ID, and keeping eye contact, she called her by name. "Lindsay, stay with us." With tears in her eyes, Woods explained that later they had to take the dead young woman off a backboard to make it available for someone else who was alive. The day ended with the story of Martin Richard, perhaps the emblematic face of youth lost at the marathon. With almost eerie self-control, Bill Richard told of the Hobson's dilemma of a father with three children and a wife all taken out by the horrifying hurricane-like blast captured by a surveillance camera at the Forum restaurant. In one arm, he carried his older son. In the other, his daughter Jane, who was missing part of her leg. They had to try to save Jane, he told his wife, who was lying on the street. Behind him, Bill Richard left his 8-year-old son, Martin. I just knew from what I saw that there was no chance. Of such testimony, there will likely be much more for jurors who no doubt are thankful for an end to the week. I'm David Boeri from the Federal Courthouse in Boston.
Well, if you want to hear more about the trial, you can check out a new podcast from WBUR and the Boston Globe. It's called Finish Line, Inside the Boston Marathon Bombing. You can find a link at hereandnow.org or go to iTunes and search for Finish Line to subscribe. Thousands of people are headed to Selma, Alabama this weekend to mark a pivotal moment in the civil rights movement. It was 50 years ago this Sunday when 600 marchers headed east out of town towards the state capital, Montgomery. They were marching for equal voting rights for blacks. They never made it out of town, though. Alabama state troopers attacked them as clouds of tear gas wafted around the Edmund Pettus Bridge. The photos were seen around the world, and historians credit the outrage that followed for passage of the Voting Rights Act later that year. Well, now, 50 years later, there's a project at Duke University to keep the fight for voting rights alive. Charlie Cobb is a veteran of the civil rights movement. He was part of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, back in the 60s, and he joins us now. Charlie, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by another person that's part of this project at Duke University, Amina Bility, who is an undergrad at Duke. Amina, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Amina, let me start with you. The project that you are both involved in is called One Person, One Vote. We'll link to it at our website, hereandnow.org. But what's the goal?
Basically, the goal of the project is to make the history of a Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, accessible to the public, and to kind of bring the history down to the grassroots and explain kind of the grassroots history of the movement. So it wasn't just one or two people who led the civil rights movement. It was people, local people in Mississippi, and young people like the SNCC veterans who made the movement possible.
But bring that history back for what purpose today in 2015?
Well, I think the history is still so relevant to issues that are going on today, and it's also important to understand the sacrifices that people like Charlie have made in order for us to be able to vote now and why we need to continue fighting for social justice in the present.
As a veteran, if you will, or participant in the movement of the 1960s, I have a lot of dissatisfactions with the history, because I think a lot of things are left out. The Selma to Montgomery March, for instance, was much more than a 5-day march to Montgomery, Alabama. There are 3 years of organizing work that preceded it. Mm. There are all kinds of people that were involved in the Southern movement. And I think both the involvement of those people and what they did, as Amina pointed out, contain very useful lessons for today.
Well, let's look back to some of the history here. And one of the people who we all know was involved on that day in Selma was Congressman John Lewis, who was one of the leaders of the march. Here he is speaking during an interview at the Aspen Institute.
And you saw these guys putting on their gas masks. They came toward us, beating us with nightsticks, tramping us with horses, and releasing the tear gas. I was the first one to be hit. I was hit in the head by a state trooper with a nightstick. And I had a concussion at the bridge. My legs went from under me. I thought I saw death. I thought I was going to die.
Charlie, what are your thoughts when you hear that?
Well, John was the chairman of SNCC when this happened. All of us were familiar with this kind of police violence, this kind of brutality. I have lots of images that run through my mind, not only in Selma, but in Mississippi where I worked and other parts of the South, of the kind of violence that people confronted in order to gain the right to vote. It's part of what makes exercising the right to vote today so important.
Amina, what about you? When you hear that, and you weren't alive at that point, but when you hear that now, what does it mean to you?
I think what it means to me is it just kind of reminds me of the sacrifice that other people have made so that I can have the right to vote and how important it is to protect that right. And also, it also reminds me, you know, in doing my research and for making the site, you know, this kind of violence, like Charlie said, was so common and so endemic in the rural South at that time. And so, you know, when we learn about civil rights history in school, we learn about, you know, Bloody Sunday and how this, like, this is the spectacular violence that happened during those times. But really, this was almost normal back during that time.
Well, and what happened that day to John Lewis and others did, as we said, help lead to the passage of the Voting Rights Act later that year. President Lyndon Johnson signed the bill into law on August 6, 1965. Here's part of what he said that day.
This act flows from a clear and simple wrong. Its only purpose is to right that wrong.
And today, as we know, because of a decision by the Supreme Court, a key tenet of the 1965 Act has been struck down, leading to some of these voter ID laws in many states. Charlie, what do you think that what you and Amina and others are doing can do in terms of the voting restrictions that are going on now?
Well, one of the things that the site does, this one person, one vote site does, is show the power of ordinary people, what ordinary people can do when they make up their minds to struggle for change. That's really what's essential to understand and what Selma represents. Selma represents 3 years of work that preceded that march across the bridge. And who was doing that work? Ordinary people, maids, sharecroppers, cooks, day workers, and the like. The site shows this, and it shows the why of this, and hopefully it will inspire people to continue to struggle in this era that we're in now of voter suppression.
Do your African-American friends vote?
Do mine?
Yeah.
Yes. All of my friends, as far as I know, vote. You know, we all are old enough to remember what it was like when we couldn't vote.
And what about you, Amina?
I would just say that my friends in general, I think my friends from North Carolina are very aware of the efforts to suppress the vote in North Carolina, especially the youth vote. And so they do vote.
They're more likely to vote because of that.
Because of that, because they know that there have been efforts to make it a little bit more difficult for young people to vote in North Carolina. But I would say my friends from out of state are probably less likely to vote.
Why do you think that is?
I just think that I don't think it's political apathy so much as that people feel that so frustrated maybe by the political system that they feel that their vote won't matter anyway.
But do you think that these restrictions, that these voter ID laws are keeping people from going out and voting, people that want to vote?
Well, I think that I guess it's hard to understand for someone who, you know, drives a car maybe why it's these laws do suppress the vote. But for people who might be homeless or who don't have ID or who are older or people like me, like I only got my state issue ID I got my state issue ID so I could vote. So I didn't have a driver's license, so I had to go get a state issue ID so I could vote. And I think that just like even those extra little steps, the average person doesn't think about that, but it is, for some people, it can be prohibitive.
Charlie Cobb, what do you think about that?
Yes, I think it particularly affects poor people. It's inconvenience. I mean, part of the way they suppressed the vote in the 1960s was with literacy tests and all kinds of other inconveniences. Now, these voter ID laws, the shrinkage of hours in which you can actually cast a ballot, the reduction of time in which you can vote absentee really affect. I would say, and I have not, I must acknowledge, not seen a quantitative study of this, but really affect that bottom quartile of the society and reduces their participation in the political process.
And another thing I would like just to say for me is one of the restrictions that the General Assembly made was reducing early registration for teenagers. So basically, when you signed up to get your driver's license, you could just check a box saying that you were going to register to vote as well. And so removing that restriction just made it even harder for younger people to register. So I think that what the site shows is that you know, we just want to make voting as accessible as possible. And, you know, it's our basic right as citizens. And I think that any efforts to just make that more difficult should be questioned.
Charlie, do you think anything like Selma could happen today that people would be willing to go out and march and put themselves in danger for a cause like voting rights?
Well, we see within the context of police violence, Ferguson and other places, that people are willing to go out and march. That's part of what the Black Lives Matters movement represents. I don't think, quite frankly, that people who march, say, against voter registration, voter suppression laws, would be faced with the kind of violence that people marching on the Edmund Pettus Bridge face, you know, a sheriff, a posse, state highway patrolmen, cattle prods, and tear gas. So violence is really not very much in the equation when it comes to protest at this point.
Charlie Cobb, who was involved in the civil rights movement back in the 60s, and Amina Bilodi, a student at Duke University. Both of them are involved in the One Person, One Vote project at Duke. We'll link to it at our website, hereandnow.org. Charlie, Amina, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And by the way, President Obama will be in Selma for the 50th anniversary commemoration this weekend. After 8 years and 3 billion miles, NASA's Dawn spacecraft finally slipped into orbit around Ceres. That's a dwarf planet between Mars and Jupiter. The big moment happened early this morning, and it is historic on many levels. Joining us for more is Dr. Jim Green, director of the Planetary Science Division at NASA. Dr. Green, welcome.
Oh, my pleasure.
And this must be a very exciting day for you.
It is. You know, Dawn has just done a fantastic job. It's made it. This is its second tour in the asteroid belt. I don't know if you knew that. It actually orbited Vesta for a whole year in 2011. And Vesta is that second largest asteroid in the asteroid belt. And we learned an enormous amount about that body. And now we're at Ceres.
And Ceres, you say we're at Ceres. Ceres is still 40,000 miles away, right? And Dawn won't be able to actually take pictures until next month.
Yes, that's true. What's happened is we actually flew a little ahead of it and then slowed down because we have ion engines. And then we stopped the ion engines, and then Ceres gravity took over and is now pulling us back. Now, what will happen is we'll begin to orbit the body from the night side before we go to the day side. And so that means we won't really have any images until we get on the day side of the dwarf planet. And that won't happen until we get into early April.
And what are you hoping to learn about Ceres from this Dawn spacecraft?
Well, Ceres is a real enigma in many ways. You know, all of a sudden we now realize it has an icy crust. We believe, of course, life and water are intimately connected, at least here on Earth they are, and the life we know exists does. And so if there's any way for this body to have a liquid layer, and that's possible because, you know, as you go down in a gravitationally held body like this, the interior heats up. So if you've got an icy crust somewhere below the ice, it might be hot enough to actually melt. And there might be a water layer there.
Dr. Green, since you are the director of the Planetary Science Division at NASA, I do want to ask you about some other news today, which is some news about an old ocean that we found existed on Mars.
Yeah, this is really another fascinating discovery. You know, from our ground-based telescopes in Hawaii, they've been observing Mars for many years, and they've been looking for the deuterium connected to oxygen, making it heavy water. And if we make that calculation, now that we know that the polar caps on Mars have a significant amount of heavy water, we can then back out how much normal water, or, you know, H2O, not heavy water, it had at one time. And it turns out to be an enormous amount. In fact, a huge ocean is believed to have existed perhaps for as much as 1.5 billion years. and therefore it had clouds, and it must have rained, and it had a hydrological cycle, and you know. So this is another great discovery that we've just made.
Dr. Jim Green, director of the Planetary Science Division at NASA, on a big day for NASA on a number of levels. Dr. Green, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And our next story may not be appropriate for everyone. In India today, several thousand people stormed a prison and dragged away a man who was accused of rape and then killed him. This follows the controversy over a documentary about the 2012 gang rape and murder of a female student in Delhi. The filmmaker interviewed one of the convicted rapists, and a court has banned the documentary from being aired in India. The BBC's Rahul Tandon joins us from Calcutta. And Rahul, before we talk about the film, tell us more about what happened at the prison today.
Yeah, I mean, this is a case that has been all over the headlines here in India today. We're coming up to that time where a lot of people will be sat in front of their TV stations and catching up on the day's news. And Dimapur will be very high in there because we had several thousand people who stormed this prison in northeastern India where they dragged away a man who was accused of rape. Basically, the police said there was nothing much that they could do about this. And I think once again, Jeremy, as you said in your introduction, it puts into the news and really highlights India's struggle, I think, to deal with issues regarding rape, whether it's justice for the families, whether it's protecting people who have been accused of rape and as of yet have not been through the legal process, and shows you that it is one of the burning issues that the world's largest democracy is still trying to deal with a few years on from the Delhi rape, which I'm sure many of your listeners will remember so vividly.
Well, and of course, this documentary is all over the news in India. Here's a clip from it, by the way. This has been shown on the BBC. This is Maria Misra, a historian at Oxford University.
Before this event, there was still a very, very strong culture of shame around rape. And so you would get politicians saying the most extraordinary things about rape victims, that it was better that a rape victim had died, because had she lived, she would just be a walking corpse.
Rahul, why is this film not being shown in India?
Well, the government here, I think, feels, firstly, they say that there's an appeals process that's taking place for some of those who've been found guilty of the case. So it's not appropriate for this documentary to be in the public domain. They also say that the BBC and the filmmakers themselves have not adhered to the terms of the access to the jail in the first place, that this was a film that was not supposed to be shot for commercial interest as well. I think more deeply and more honestly than that, Jeremy, the feeling here in India from the government and, one has to say, from a fairly large segment of the population as well here, is that this could damage India's, you know, reputation internationally. It's not something that they want to see. And others say that within the documentary, of course, one of those who was involved in the rape of the young girl in Delhi expresses his views. He shows no remorse at all. And some people say that no platform should be given to people like that. Of course, there are millions of other people here who have very different views from that. It's an issue that is dividing society. As I'm talking to you now, the Editors Guild here in India has come out and said that the government must show this film. It's something that every Indian should see because they have to understand why these problems are still facing this country.
But there are concerns about copycat crimes, I've read.
That is a view that has been put forward not just by the government, but by senior figures from within the women's movement in this country as well, who worry that some of those who are highlighted in the documentary could almost become like heroes in this country, which you know, may sound a bit bizarre, but you know, the simple fact is that there are some people, probably many people in this country, who hold some of the views that many people may find distasteful that are put forward by the rapists in this documentary. I think this whole issue comes at a time when the whole issue of freedom in India is one that is being discussed, you know, almost every hour in this country. We've had the banning of the serving of beef in Maharashtra, one of India's most popular states. We have one of India's most prominent satire groups at the moment facing a legal action for some sketches that they've done as well. So I think beyond the issue of rape, which is, of course, a very difficult one for this country to deal with, we also have the issue of freedom of speech, which is something that many countries are battling with at the moment.
And the issue of how women are treated.
I think that is the fundamental issue here, isn't it? And I think the honest answer here that I think many even within authority, within the government, would accept is that a few years on from the Delhi rape, that in spite of all the discussion, in spite of all the talk, in spite of the fact that, you know, the the way that these crimes are dealt with is speeded up at the moment. When you're talking about changing attitudes in a country of more than 1.3 billion people, that is going to take some time. So, you know, in your, when we heard that clip there about women still, women who were shamed for being raped, it's the worst thing that could happen to somebody. It is still like that in many parts of this country. And if you go to rural India at the moment, you will find many women, unfortunately, who have been assaulted, who still feel scared to go to the police at the moment. There are many women who say they wouldn't go and report rapes even in cities like Kolkata because they say there's not enough female police on the streets at the moment. They don't want to walk into a police station full of men. I was talking to tourists on these very streets just a few weeks ago who said that they were worried about traveling in buses because of what had happened to the young girl in Delhi. So away from whether this documentary should be shown or should not be shown, the real issue of whether the lives of women are changing in India is one I think that many people here would say it's not moving as quickly as it should do.
That's the BBC's Rahul Tandon on the busy streets of Calcutta, India. Rahul, thank you so much as always.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
Well, the very first drone film festival takes place tomorrow night in New York. Here now, tech partner IEEE Spectrum sent senior editor David Schneider to see what all the buzz is about.
It shouldn't take the whirring of a small drone to remind you that many people are awfully leery of these little aerial contraptions, fearing threats to privacy and also to airplanes. But others see great benefits, particularly cinematographers who are thrilled to make use of the unique perspectives drones can provide. Some of the best examples of what they can achieve will be screened tomorrow at the first ever Drone Film Festival in New York City.
My name is Randy Scott Slavin. I am the founder and festival director of the New York City Drone Film Festival.
Slavin's inspiration for putting on this event grew out of his own experiences.
I bought this thing called the DJI Phantom, and it's the iPod of drones. The idea that I could shoot anything I wanted from any angle was just super exciting to me. I had hours and hours and hours worth of footage around New York, and I finally decided to edit. I had some downtime. I put it online, and you know, within the next couple of days, it was like I got calls from like Fox News and Time Magazine and like Mashable and Gizmodo. And when you do something that winds up catching on virally, you submit it to film festivals. So I looked around. I was like, okay, let me see whether Cannes had a drone category or Sundance had a drone category or Berlin had a drone category or South by Southwest had a drone category. And there were none. And that's when the idea came to me.
Although filmmakers have long used helicopters for aerial shots, Slavin says small drones offer many advantages.
When it comes down to aerial cinematography via helicopter, there's tons of stories. Every single cinematographer has a story about problems with the helicopter or some kind of crash they know. With a drone, there's not going to be that.
It's also much less expensive to hire a drone operator.
That's Kim Jackson. She's the Drone Festival's producer.
It's going to benefit us in our community for television and film and commercial, really impacting the budget in a positive way.
So does all this mean that drone cinematography could one day become a distinct new art form? Slavin and Jackson don't really expect that to happen. But this drone film festival does have a purpose.
Really what the film festival does, as far as I'm concerned, is it's going to shed light on the drone pilots.
What they do is not easy. You know, we can't just pick up a drone and just start shooting and create a piece of art. It is extremely difficult. These guys are masters.
I think everybody is coming into this thinking that it's going to be 2 hours worth of, you know, flyovers over like mountain ranges. And while drones do that exceptionally well, there were so many amazing uses of drones creatively. Drone cinema is not just flying over things.
Slavin's talking about things like hovering next to a waterfall or flying around inside a cathedral.
These films that we're screening are mind-blowing. For all of us out there in the industry looking for the next way to creatively tell a story, this is going to be extremely inspiring.
So you can expect to see plenty of awesome drone shots on the silver screen, even if you're not at tomorrow's Drone Film Festival. For Here and Now in New York City, I'm David Schneider.
Do you have to check your own drone in at the door?
Yeah, at the door.
No drone flying at the event.
Yeah, no drone.
And by the way, we're trying to get Lady Gaga to come in the Volantis. And essentially, it's a huge drone dress.
Wow.
No joke. Look it up.
We're going to look it up. David's story came to us from our tech partner, IEEE Spectrum. Should the U.S. ambassador to South Korea have been better protected? Today, the AP reports that his attacker, a pro-unification activist, is so well known that when he entered the breakfast meeting where the attack took place, a police officer asked the event organizers, the Korean Council for Reconciliation and Cooperation, if he should be allowed in. He was, and he slashed Ambassador Mark Lippert with a 10-inch knife. Who provides protection for U.S. ambassadors, and should there be more after one was killed in the attack on a U.S. compound in Benghazi, Libya? Ambassador Christopher Hill is the dean of the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He served as ambassador to Iraq, Poland, Macedonia, and South Korea. He's just returned from Korea. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You know, there have already been calls for more protection. So first start with, how does it work? We presume it depends on how friendly the country is seen as being to the U.S., but who provides security?
It's not just the friendliness of the country, it's what the overall level of security is in the country. And according to the Vienna Convention, it is the responsibility of the host country to take care of foreign diplomats. And that is why in many countries you'll see rings of foreign of the host country policemen around the embassy to protect the embassy. Now, obviously, the U.S. has certain protections as well. We have Marine guards to protect classified information. But generally speaking, with some notable exceptions, we ask the host government to provide protection if there's if there needs to be protection of the ambassador. And so when I was in the Republic of Korea, I had a Korean law enforcement official assigned to me as a sort of close-in protection, otherwise known as a bodyguard.
Well, we understand in this case, the U.S. embassy had its own small security detail, but by South Korean law, South Korea doesn't provide protection unless it's asked. It wasn't asked, but still sent some police officers anyway. So not a lot of protection there. But does it surprise you that a man with a knife who'd had a history, he was charged with throwing a piece of concrete at the Japanese ambassador in 2010. Are you surprised he was allowed to even go in and get so close?
Frankly, I am surprised by that. I don't quite understand why the organizers would have made him a member of their organization and sat him in a at a table that was in close proximity to our ambassador. So I find that a bit of a mystery. I don't, however, feel this is something on the U.S. side or at the embassy side. I think this has to do with the organizers and their ability to hold a proper event without this kind of disruption.
Well, as you know, it's led to these calls for more protection. People saying that, especially post-Benghazi and in the current global climate, ambassadors should be ringed with protection. What does that do?
Well, look, this is all about managing risk. You cannot avoid risk. I mean, there's risk all over the world, so you have to manage it. And I think with respect to South Korea, risk is well managed. That is, there is a bodyguard with the ambassador. There's a very good relationship, good information flow between host country police and law enforcement and the U.S. Embassy's security office. So I think by all accounts, risk is well managed in South Korea. When I was in Iraq, I had an army go with me when I visited the foreign ministry or something. I had something like 25 people, including a helicopter overhead. And I think risk was well managed there, but at a different level, obviously.
But it sounds like you're saying you still have to be out there because you're an ambassador.
You got it. And, you know, it is really about the fact that, of course, you could minimize risk by locking the ambassador up in his or her office all day. But an ambassador has to be out there. And as a public official, as a public figure, there's a certain amount of risk associated with that. I must say, Ambassador Lippert and many of his predecessors, including myself, I mean, we'd often walk alone on the streets of Seoul. I mean, this is not a place that's perceived as high threat. I mean, it's one thing when you have the U.S. president visiting a country to have metal detectors and the like, but I think normally in a country like Korea, which is pretty well buttoned up, I think going into a breakfast meeting without necessarily having people all frisked is within what I would consider risk parameters.
Yeah, I mean, the point is that if this man got into a breakfast event, he was going to get a utensil. So the question is, how did he get in? That still seems to be the question.
That is a question. I'd like to know how that organization would have had a person like that. I mean, he had a public record. He had a suspended jail sentence, but he was guilty of attacking the Japanese ambassador. So what was he doing in that event and as a member of that organization? So I think that is a fair question to be investigating, and I'm sure the Republic of Korea authorities will get to the bottom of that.
Ambassador Christopher Hill, again, served as ambassador to Iraq, Poland, Macedonia, South Korea. Now he's dean of the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. Ambassador Hill, thank you.
Thank you very much.